Kia ora Aotearoa and welcome to a new season of Generally Famous. I'm Simon Bridges and every week I talk to a generally famous but always interesting guest about life, love and what makes them tick. Today's guest, Liam Lawson, is a motor racing driver who at just 20 is already one of our greatest. Having won pretty much everything you can in New Zealand and Australia, he's been racing more internationally for about 4 years, graduating through the levels to be on the cusp of the ultimate in racing, a spot in Formula One. Liam, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, look, there's so much to talk about. Let's not muck around. When you're racing internationally, how fast are you going?
Like speed, like actual speed wise, it depends on what car we're driving. So in Formula 2 this year, the fastest I've driven was in Formula 1 when we did the testing. But in Formula 2, we're not like terminal top speed. We're not actually too far off Formula 1. It's about 330 we hit in Baku in Azerbaijan, which is basically a street circuit with a massively long straight. And I would say, yeah.
But so that's top speed on the straight?
That's top speed, but our cars are not, that's not the sort of impressive part about the Formula cars, about with the downforce that they have. It's the cornering speeds, especially in the high speed corners. That's where it's, they sort of are a lot faster than normal race cars or like a GT or a supercar or something.
So
like
if
that.
You're 320 something, let's say, on the straight, what are you doing around the corner?
It depends. So in a section like, so Suzuka, for example, I just tested in Japan in a Super Formula car there. And the first sector is a section of really high speeds, like S's. And we basically corner through those at about 200 and 250 kilometers an hour. And that's going hard left, back to right. Compared to in a normal car, you'd probably be doing 100 maybe or less through those corners.
What is that like?
It's really hard on your neck. So the G-force is really, really high. So you're basically, we do a lot of neck training. So I always look like an idiot. I'm the guy in the gym who's like got a band around my head against a pole trying to hold my head up. But it's, yeah, important because if you can't hold your head up, you sort of can't really see where you're going. So
right.
Yeah.
So it's because I've seen on, you know, Drive to Survive and so on, yeah, the neck stuff. I thought maybe that was like a safety thing or something, but it's actually also just for you and your sort of more than comfort, but comfort when you're driving.
It's really important. It's probably that one of the most important parts of it. Yeah.
So don't be, you can be rude to me. It's not a problem. If I was in one of these, other than the fact I'd crash and die, if I was in one of these and I was going that fast and I had the G's on me at that level and I haven't obviously done any of that training, let alone any other kind of training, what would happen to me?
Yeah, you like, it's the same as if I hadn't driven. Like we obviously gradually step up in the cars, and if I'd gone from a lower speed car that I drove a couple of years ago into something like I drive now, I wouldn't be able to do it either. So yeah, you wouldn't be able to hold your head up. We have headrests which are kind of sort of close, so you can rest your head, but it's quite far off, and you wouldn't really see where you're going. So
I wouldn't have the muscle strength in my neck to hold my head up. My head would be down.
That's the other thing, is braking is one of the biggest, most important parts, because in a corner, I guess you can rest your head a little bit, but when you're braking, if you can't hold your head up basically straight, which the first time I drove a Formula 2 car, the first time I braked for the first corner, my head dropped literally into my lap. I couldn't see the corner. So if that sort of fatigues and you can't hold your head up, then you literally can't see where you're going.
And it's like so much an elite sport of kind of many kinds, you know, as you say, you're graduating and you're slowly building up to this. But how long have you, for example, been going at those sort of speeds and having to sort of have that strength?
Wow. Formula, the first sort of high downforce fast car that I drove would have been a Formula 3 car, and that was in 2019. So I was probably 17 years old. So, but before that, it's more entry level stuff like Formula 4 is a very basic sort of car, which was my first, it was 2018 was first year I went to Europe. But yeah, everything onwards from Formula 3 is quite high speeds.
Again, and I ask this, I hope it doesn't sound like a dumbass, but you know, we're sitting here, I'm sitting there, I'm never going to get in one of these. It's never going to happen. And that's true for most Kiwis, right? Virtually all Kiwis. Just give us a sense of you're in there, you're racing this high-tech rocket ship, you know, on the ground, as you say, not just on the straits, but around these corners, all the skill that you've got. What's the physical feeling?
You definitely adjust to it, but the biggest thing is when you haven't driven for a long time. So we train a lot to be able to cope with the like the G, and because it is very physical to drive. So when you drive a lot, you sort of just become race fit and you get used to it. But when you haven't driven for a while, it's really quite challenging. So these 2 months now where I'm home is some of the most important sort of points of the year where I have to really train a lot, because when you get out of the car for a while, it gets really tough to basically get back in. And if you're not completely comfortable, like my seats in Japan I recently drove wasn't completely comfortable, so you get quite a lot of marks, like bruises on your body and things like that.
So in this 2 month period where you've, you know, had a year out from it, a year I should say, of racing, and you're what's your kind of daily regime?
At the moment, it's been pretty relaxed, but in the next sort of couple of weeks, it'll probably ramp back up again. So I have a trainer in the UK who I spend probably 5 days a week with when I'm there. And then, so when I'm home, he'll basically send me through programs to do training-wise. I do a lot of cycling as well. I'm trying to get hold of a bike while I'm here because I couldn't bring mine home. But that's where we sort of base the, I guess, cardio endurance-based training is on the bike. And the stuff we do in the gym is more strength endurance based.
Of course, you know, look, there's thousands of things that have to happen before you even get into the car, right? And while you're in it, you've got a huge support team. What's the team like in F2? How many people are there helping you out? You know, in the year, in 2022, you know, when you've been in F2, what's your support team like?
F2 is it's completely limited in terms of the amount of crew members you're allowed on the car, and compared to Formula One,
that's in the rules.
Yeah, exactly. So compared to F1, that was one of the biggest things when I went and did the Formula One test, was getting used to having 3-4 times the amount of people. In F2, we probably have 20 to 30 people, like as in the crew on a weekend, 20 people maybe. And whereas in Formula One, it's like 50. Probably more than that, probably 100 people.
Focused on that car.
Yeah, focused on car. Just two on the two cars and the team. So, yeah, when basically getting used to sitting in the car and just having all these people around you. I have one engineer in F2 who I talk to, whereas in Formula One, there's like 4 engineers who stand next to the car, and then there's another team of them back in the hospitality area behind you. And then at the same time, there's another full crew of people back in Milton Keynes in the UK every race weekend who are basically live talking to the team all the time, looking at every single bit of information. So a lot more people involved.
How much of that engineering stuff do you have to understand?
A lot, and every year it gets more important, especially when I went to Formula One to start testing. But you can always know more, and I like am continuing to learn stuff about it, because especially every car you drive gets more and more complex, so there's always new things that you sort of learn. Like when I went to Japan, the cars there are slightly more different, a lot more sensitive to sort of aerodynamics of the car, and some stuff that I didn't really understand before that I'm still learning. So it is important, because also the feedback that you give the engineers, they have all the data in front of them, but the most important part about setting up the car comes from the driver. So you have to like tell them exactly what you're feeling, and they change like different things on the car, and then you have to sort of feedback to the team at what you're feeling and what's good and what's not good about it.
Is it dangerous? I mean, it is dangerous, but you know, and every so often, thankfully not, you know, all the time, you know, people are badly injured and or, you know, on occasion die. I mean, do you think about that, and are you the sense of the danger that's involved?
No, I don't. It is dangerous, obviously. I've been lucky not to really have any really big sort of accidents.
Spills or crashes, injuries?
Yeah, touch wood. But yeah, is this wood?
I think it's some kind of fibre.
Yeah, well,
some kind.
It's actually, yeah, basically I've... Yeah, let me just quickly... Thank you.
There you go, you've touched some.
Yeah, so I've been lucky not to have any big sort of accidents. But it is obviously just because of the speed, it's the impacts that sort of are the worst. So the cars are very, very safe. Like we're strapped in, our seats are completely molded to our body, so we don't move at all. It's just when you're doing 300 kilometers an hour, when you hit something at that speed, it's just the sort of I guess, the impact that is what can sort of hurt you.
You broken any bones?
No, I've never broken anything. I've been really, really lucky. Even in a go-kart, I have a lot of friends that when they were go-karting growing up, they like flipped the go-karts. I've never gone upside down in anything. So yeah, have been lucky, but you can't think, but to answer your question, you can't think about that.
Because you'd be paralyzed at least. I mean, you couldn't sort of cope with that.
Exactly. When you're doing that speed and you're sort of touching wheels with other cars and stuff like that, if there's any fear in you, you're going to be the first guy who's going to back out of that. So you have to be, you can't think about the dangers.
And on the mental side of it, right, we sort of already touched on this, but one of the things I saw with you is, I think it was when you were about to take Max Verstappen's Formula One car for a spin, you'd said something along the lines of, you were up the night before going through the manuals, right? I mean, so it's, I suppose, probably people don't think this, but you could have a view of saying, you do your neck exercise, you get in this thing, you put your pedal to the metal and you rock it, right? But it's a very, there's study and preparation and, just give us a sense of that.
That's really for Formula One, because the cars are the hybrids, so they have a battery system. And with that battery system, it's so much more complex. There's so many switches that you sort of have to change. There's performance switches, which when I say performance, I mean as a driver, I can slightly change how the car's like driving, which is good. But then there's also not performance switches, but stuff that the engineer will call you to change, and that can be once, twice a lap that they'll tell you to change certain things. That'll help their side because they can't do it. It's to make it our lives harder. It's basically they want us to really operationally do everything that that needs to be done, and that they don't do it. So, and you don't really have that so much through the junior categories. Like we change quite a lot in Formula 2, and other cars will change like brake bias, which is the like percentage of bias between the front and rear. So if you're like locking a lot of fronts, if you're braking and you're locking front wheels, because we don't have ABS, then you'll go backwards on brake bias or vice versa. Whereas in Formula One, there's a lot more changes. So just trying to understand how to operate the car was probably the biggest challenge about it. Because for example, in a qualifying lap in a Formula One car, so when we were doing, obviously I didn't qualify the car, but in the practice sessions that we did, we do simulations of things. So we'll do long runs, we'll do short runs, and we'll do qualifying simulations. And I'll do exactly what the main drivers will do in a qualifying session, and quite often we'll change 5 to 6 switches a lap, basically. So in your qualifying lap, when you're driving as fast as you can and you're trying to get everything out of it, you're also changing 5 or 6 different dials over the lap to give you sort of that maximum performance.
What about in terms of, I mean, you're 20, I can tell from you, you're fit as anything. I'm sure
you're
mentally fit. Yeah, well, don't look at me, all right? Don't say anything about that. But you'll also, mentally be strong. But in terms of kind of your mental preparation, even at F2, I shouldn't say even, because it's very elite sport as well, you have psychological coaches, trainers, people preparing you kind of mentally. I know they sort of seem to at that F1 level. You had that sort of thing at F2?
Yeah, so I've had since I first moved to Europe, actually, when I was 16, I've had a coach who is more of a performance coach, an all-round performance coach, rather than a driver coach, because especially at like Formula 2, Formula 3 level, you shouldn't need a driver coach to teach you how to drive the car. So he's been with me since I was 16, 17 years old. And basically where I've got the most out of it has been the mental side of things. So he travels with me everywhere. Anytime anything happens, whether it's good or bad in the car, he's the first person I talk to. He's the person I tell absolutely
Kiwi?
Everything. No, he's actually from the UK. He's British. He's been a massive part of helping me basically get to.
How's he helped you? What do you think that's been there that you couldn't have done if it was just you as, Liam, 16-year-old or even 20-year-old for that matter?
I think even literally as simple as losing my cool and doing something stupid, that he's sort of helped. Like I said, he's a person I talked about everything. So if something's, going on within the team or something like that I'm really frustrated, whether I've had a really bad race or something like that, he helped me a lot in the first year I was with Red Bull. It was a lot of pressure when you're the first year with Red Bull. Every driver, it's the year that they haven't invested that much into you, so it's not the end of the world for them if they don't like you to just ax you. Exactly. Yeah. So that first year is really high pressure. And I remember struggling a lot with it. I was in a team in Formula 3 that it wasn't a competitive team. We couldn't win races at the time. And there were other Red Bull drivers in different teams that were fighting for race wins. And I remember thinking, I'm going to get dropped because I'm not performing at their level and stuff like this. And he was a massive part of helping me just focus on things that were within my control, because I was worrying about stuff that I couldn't do anything about it. So it was pointless worrying about it, and sort of helped me get through that season at that point. So it's more of the mental stuff that he's been a big help with.
I presume he helps you, you know, before a race, get in the zone.
Yeah, warm up and stuff like that. So it's quite funny because he's not a physio, and a lot of drivers have their physios with them. But we do our own sort of warm up and stuff like that, and we make it work. But especially when you reach Formula 1, in fact, most guys in Formula 2, to be fair, have, like, I have a trainer who I train with, but he doesn't come with me to the races. So Enzo is my coach, sort of fills that role. The only problem is if I get injured, I don't have that guy to, you know, give me, he's not the expert on that. Yeah. So,
well, you haven't had too many, so that's
been lucky,
good.
Exactly.
Yeah. But and just final one on the mental thing, like, we were talking off here, you know, heroes and so on, and realize, oh, you actually, now you're racing, or you may be, you know, before too long racing against some of these, you know, global names. I feel like I would be intimidated up against the Lewis Hamiltons and the Max Verstappens and the, you know, Ricciardos and the various others. Has that ever been a mental game for you?
When I was younger, yeah, these Formula One drivers, like Lewis Hamilton was somebody I really looked up to when I was a kid. I read his book when I was younger, and I used to obviously watch him in Formula One and stuff like that. So I liked, you know, I looked up to him a lot, but it's got to a point where, you know, you get old enough and you start to realize that eventually, if you want to make Formula One, you're going to be racing against these guys. So you don't want to be looking up to them. They're not your heroes anymore. They're guys that you want to be racing against. So, yeah, probably a good few years ago, something that Enzo actually was my coach, because I used to put people on pedestals, you know, a lot. I'd see a driver and be like, oh, you know, look who it is and stuff like that. And at the end of the day, they're just people. Like you or me. So I sort of stopped doing that, because, yeah, it's true. I would like to be obviously racing these guys and being on track with them.
Well, they're all just people that eat and poo and sleep and all of those things. Yeah. I want to just go back to the beginning. We'll come back to some of this. But, you know, you're born in Pukekohe. Oh, no, I shouldn't say Hastings.
Hastings.
Grew up in Pukekohe. Pretty normal Kiwi upbringing.
Very, very normal. First 3-4 years of school, probably didn't wear shoes to school for that period. Very normal. I started go-karting at 7 years old, 6 or 7 years old, and up until I was probably 12. I went to high school in Pukekohe, but only for...
So were you karting when you were sort of 7, 8, 9?
Yeah.
Where?
Oh, we're at Mount Wellington.
Right.
Mount Wellington was...
And then a bit at Rosebank, which I know a bit. Yeah.
And then when it became very serious and sort of we realised it was... Because my first... I don't know if you know this, but my first couple of years of go-karting, my first probably year of go-karting, was terrible. Like, I was 7, 8 years old, but I would finish stone dead last consistently every single weekend. Like I was, you know, as a kid, I'm telling my dad, you know, Dad, the car sucks, like the engine sucks. And it did. But as a 7 year old, my dad's going to be like, yeah, Liam, you know, I know. But he's in the back of his head thinking that his kid just sucks. So it was more of a fun thing for a year. And eventually he gave in and listened to me, and he invested in these sort of two really good cadet motors for this class I was in. And I still remember putting them on for the first time at this big major event for the qualifying session. And, you know, I'd been running at the very, very back of the field for a long time. And I remember looking at him and some, you know, sort of looking at me, and we kind of realized this was the moment where we sort of find out. And I put the thing on pole and started the race sort of first. And from that moment, it became very serious. And that's when we started putting a lot more into karting. And I was lucky.
So how old were you then? You're talking 8, 9?
Probably eight years old at that point. Yep. Eight years old.
And would you say then you sort of thought, oh, I'd like to be an F1?
I bet it was since I was like 3-4 years old. It was always cars. It wasn't just cars. It was anything with an engine, anything with wheels.
You know, it's not like your family was big in motorsport or anything at any level. Can I confirm, you know, you didn't come from big money or any of that. So there weren't these factors there that sometimes are in some of the names we see. Was your dad, though, into motorsport?
Weirdly, when I was born, sort of the years that I was born, he started to watch it. And that's why I started watching it, because of him. But he wasn't, nobody ever raced. So none of my family, none of my, like, even other, like, you know, relative family didn't race. So I don't know where it sort of came from, but one of my best friends, he's still one of my best friends now, his name's Matthew Payne. He's actually racing supercars next year in Australia.
Yep,
he started at the sort of same time, a couple of months before I started, and his dad raced. His dad raced cars, and that's how he got into it. And I went and watched him at 6 years old. And even though I liked cars and I liked racing and stuff like that, my dad didn't know what to do about it. You know, I don't even think whether he knew about go-karting or not. So I went and watched my friend Matthew drive and realized that, you know, I have to do this. So yeah, dad bought a go-kart.
So you're telling me, you know, if you kind of think about sort of why you were so into this and, you know, say really young, you sort of saw this as a future. Matthew's part of it.
Matthew is part of it, yeah.
Yeah, he's to blame, if you like, not to blame. He gets the credit. Well, not that credit, but, you know, some credit for starting this. And then like, I suppose when you're telling me, you know, there at the very start, you sort of sucked, what kept you going in it?
It was more of a fun thing. I know Dad enjoyed going to the go-kart track because you talk a lot. I don't know if go-karting is really still a lot like this now. It's very competitive. But when I started doing it, it was very fun as well. Like, the dads would all talk to each other and get on and stuff like that. And us kids would basically all go to each other's trailer and hang out together. And so it was more of a fun thing to do. So I was always sticking with it. But obviously the competitive side of me was hating the fact that I was running around at the back. And although I sucked, I didn't really suck. I just had, as bad as it sounds, I had terrible gear. But to the outside, it looked like I sucked. But it is funny because
Your dad was learning with you though, right?
He's working
out what to do with it and how to get the motor going a bit better and this sort of
stuff. That's exactly it, because my dad technically has no real idea.
What'd he do for a crust? What was he?
Like job wise. Yeah. So he still doing the same thing. Now he works in freight. So ships freight around the world. Yep.
It's not like he was a motor mechanic or anything.
No, nothing. So when I started, you know, he's like, cause you have to, a big part of go-karting engine, you have to tune them a lot and to get the best out of them. And he would sort of have no idea, but be mucking around with it, trying different things. And to be fair, he learns everything really well. And the coolest part is, and something I can say is, I never had, like, loads of carts or kids have, stuff break on them, you know, like normal, and everything's mechanical, it breaks. Guys will have wheels fall off sometimes, stuff like that. I'd have a chain fall off every now and then when I'd hit a curb or something like that. That was down to I guess me. But mechanically, my car was always, my dad was really, really good at, he just put a lot of time in. Every time we come back from the track, a lot of people leave their carts in the trailer until they go out again. Dad, you know, would come back at midnight and he would take the cart out and strip it down and be out in the garage every night.
How often is he sort of, is he there with you now? Well, not really. Manage to get there? No.
So he came this year, he came to Monaco, right. which was really cool. But for a couple of years now, my parents haven't been able to see me race, yep. especially with COVID, yep. stuff like that. So, yeah. And I think, to be fair, when I first got into sort of a high level team racing where, you know, it's no longer you and dad, the last year I had that was Formula Ford in New Zealand, where yep. it was me and my dad, and my friend sort of running the car. After that, I go to Formula Four and it's a team of people with engineers and dad has to step back. And I think, I know he definitely struggles with that a bit, because my coach has got a group chat, and even to this day now, my coach is watching my race, trying to watch what I'm doing, and he's having to text my dad in this group chat and update him on everything that's going on.
Dad's got friendly advice.
Yeah, always.
Is it good? You don't want to offend your dad here, but is it good advice?
A lot of it's good advice, but sometimes he stresses a lot about some things.
How did you get, we're truncating this a bit, but, you know, what was it that got you to the Northern Hemisphere in Europe? Was it just that you kept winning? Were there defining moments? Was this a bit of a grind and you sort of...
It's crazy how it's happened, to be fair. Because like you said before, I don't come from money. So my parents haven't really paid for my racing since I was in go-karts, really.
So it hasn't been a big financial sacrifice to them?
It was. So go-karting, yep. In fact, the reason I left go-karting, everything worked out really, really well, to the point where I left go-karting when I was 12, but the only reason we left really was because it was getting too expensive. Trying to compete top level got really difficult. I was racing in Junior Rotax at this point, and they just released these new engines with this new spec, and it was crazy expensive. So my dad entered me into the Speed Sport scholarship, for Formula First. And because it was a scholarship program to race a car for a season, and if I wanted to race in cars, that would where I'd have to be eventually. So I did that at like, and luckily in New Zealand, you can drive, something we have as an advantage to other countries, we can drive cars at 12, race cars at 12, 13 years old. So I was basically doing that. And that's sort of how it happened. And then what got me to Europe was an amazing group of supporters that have just been growing and growing around me the last sort of 5-6 years. With sponsors.
And they've stumped up.
Massively.
It's, you know, fully, like, I mean, I'm not, there's nothing in it for us to, but it's like sort of the Gill Trips, Turners, Porter Group, but these outfits have stumped up and believed in you and seen something.
Exactly. It's something that obviously in New Zealand, it's motorsport's very big here, and I think all of these guys, you know, a lot of these guys want to see a New Zealand driver make Formula One, and luckily they believe in me enough to sort of invest in me and on that pathway and sort of help me make my dream. But I think for them as well, it's very exciting for all of us to, like, this group of people that we have now is grown so much, and everyone's really excited about it, which is really cool. I come home every year and get to catch up with everybody, and I guess every year we sort of are getting closer and closer, which is cool.
Yeah, amazing. How many, you know, over the last 3-4 years you've been offshore a fair bit, how many months are you offshore? I'm just trying to get a sense of it. I know there's no such thing as a normal year in your game, but what are we talking? You're away 8 months out of 12?
10, or? Probably 10, right. 10, 11 months, I would say, most seasons.
And I'm interested. I sort of follow it at a level, but I wouldn't say I'm very much not an expert at any level as well. My sense from F4 to 3 to 2 to that holy grail of 1, it's like, It's you're graduating these different levels and it gets harder every time. That's basically the picture we're talking about.
Yeah, I guess the cars get faster. The competition is, to be fair, you sort of grow up, like I've been racing, a lot of the guys I race now, I was racing in Formula 4 because everyone's sort of progressing together. And I'd say right now.
I don't know, having said all that, what's the car you've got in F4? What are you running in there?
Like what the engine and stuff like that
is. Yeah, how's it sort of compare? I'm trying to get a sense of how that compares with, say, an F2 or F1.
Formula 4 is the first wings and slicks car that you drive. A fully slick tyre with a bit of aero, not much, but it's there's definitely downforce. If you lose a wing, you know, you lose performance. It's what a lot of people are progressing from go-karting, they step into Formula 4 now, which personally I think is actually, it's not the right step. I did Formula First and Formula Ford, and for me they were a big part of teaching me sort of car control, learning how to drive on the limit, stuff like that. But yeah, it's the entry level that you jump into most likely from a go-kart. So, but still, they are, like, if when I raced Formula 4 in Australia, when we race on tracks like Surface Paradise, Gold Coast, really tight tracks, we're as quick as, I think we're pretty much as quick as a supercar. And we have, you know, obviously a third of the horsepower probably.
Yeah.
Even less. Yeah. Like, the cars are just very light and nimble and stuff like that. So, and then you go into Formula 3, which is it's a really big step. It's where you first drive with big downforce. First time I drove a Formula 3 car, I was, 15 or 16. And, after 3 or 4 laps, my head was, you know, gone, basically on the headrest. I couldn't hold my head up.
So yeah.
Every driver has something that they struggle with personally a lot, whether it's because we don't have power steering in most cars we drive. Formula 1 does, Formula 2 doesn't. A lot of guys struggle with the strength of the steering. A lot of guys struggle with neck strength. A lot of guys struggle core, something like that. For me, it's always a neck that goes first. So that's the thing that I have to really focus on quite a lot.
If you don't have time to read the in-depth stories, or you just prefer to listen instead, The Long Read From Stuff is the podcast for you. Each week we showcase one of our excellent pieces of journalism, telling important or entertaining stories from the world of crime, sport, history, culture, and more. You also get to hear from the journalists themselves about how they uncovered the story and how it came to life. So for your weekly dose of long-form journalism, beautifully read, subscribe to The Long Read From Stuff wherever you get your podcasts.
Today you're in, I mean, you tell me, but I would suggest right now that part of the hottest team in the world. signed with Red Bull, and right now I might have the terminology wrong, but what, junior driver, reserve driver?
Junior driver, which is what is basically putting me through like Super Formula, Formula 2, what I've been for the last couple of years, but as well a separate side to that, or separate, a completely separate thing is the reserve side, or Formula 1 side, where I'm a Red Bull Racing reserve rather than a Red Bull athlete junior driver, if that makes sense. So which is what basically had me alongside the Formula 1 team this year.
Right. I mean, how does that feel to be with Red Bull? I suppose I'm just trying to watching some of this and seeing sort of how it goes. I mean, it's a world away from some of these other teams, you know, in terms of the resourcing, and I know there's caps on that and all that sort of stuff, but and the know-how. And so how do you feel about that?
It's very cool. I remember when I first got the contract for reserve, and I guess, you know, technically it's my first Formula One contract, and it was a very exciting thing. I was actually having my haircut at the time, I remember, and like looking at the email, and it was really, really exciting. But at the same time, I've now had, you know, done that role this year, and it's really, really exciting. I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to be working alongside the Formula One team and be learning. But it's also just as frustrating because you're watching every weekend, and I'm just, you know, desperate to be driving the car. So I see absolutely everything, every driver's on boards. I listen to the radio communication. So, you know, I take in so much information, which is great, because eventually when I do step on a Formula One, if I am able to do that, I want to be as ready for that as possible. So
yeah, you bet.
This is all stuff that is really, really helpful.
And I presume the culture of something like that, you know, Red Bull team is, it's both supportive but very competitive. So it's this quite sort of, I mean, how would you describe the culture of it?
It's like every, most Formula One teams have a junior program now, I would say. Alpine have a junior program, Mercedes technically have a junior program, Ferrari have theirs. And obviously Red Bull have theirs, and Red Bull is probably the most iconic one, I would say, from all the years. It's had the most amount of drivers through it, and actually who have gone to Formula One as well. So it's the most direct, which is the reason that we signed for them in the first place. But at the same time, it's a very cutthroat. It's, as we talked about before, that first year was very high pressure, but every year is, you know, you're expected to win all the time. And when you don't, it's not the nicest situation to be in. You know, you're under a lot of pressure all the time. So dealing with that is quite tough. But as I said, it's also the most direct program because it's completely performance based. And for a guy like me, who doesn't,
which is good, right?
It's perfect.
You don't want anything else.
I couldn't have got to this point without them, because we just didn't have financially the money. So, it's sort of, if you're good enough, you get to go all the way.
What sort of support is there around, you know, someone who's on those programs though, like yourself? Like, I know it's a world away and everyone would much rather be a Formula driver than a Member of Parliament, but people think a Member of Parliament, right, which I was, they think there'll be the support and people, you know, will tell you what you should be doing. There's none of that. Right? I mean, what are the support systems? They put quite a lot around you to make sure you're not getting pissed every night, or you're not, you know, and you're sort of there on time, and you are turning up for your exercise regime, and you are learning how to use the car properly. And how much of that is there?
There's a lot. There is a lot. You're also expected sort of things like you know, I guess, what you do in your own time and stuff like that is sort of expected of you, to not be taking the piss and being stupid. But so I live in Milton Keynes in the UK, which is where the Red Bull Racing factory is. So I live 5 minutes away from basically the Formula One factory, and we spend a lot of time there with doing simulator work, things like that, because all our testing is restricted. We can't just go out and test like you used to be able to, otherwise teams would be spending double their budget at the moment. So it's for cost reasons, but it means that simulator driving and stuff like that has become really, really important, and also developing the car in the simulator, and that's what I do a lot of at the moment. That side of it we spend a lot of. Obviously the training side we spoke about before, and they sort of give us access to, because they have experts in pretty much every single department, whether it's nutrition or physical training or anything like that, mental performance. So we have access to speak to basically anybody. This year we spent a lot of time, even things like how to manage social media and things like that, because now you have to be so careful with what you do and say and things like that on social media, because it can completely ruin your career.
Totally.
So it's we've had things like that, presentations where we've learned exactly how to manage that, who to speak to about it and things like that. So
yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
I bet. You know Christian Horner, who's the boss of Red Bull. I know that, in as much as I know that, you know, for example, he was the one, and you know, said, come into my office and you're going to race in Max Verstappen's car, which would have been awesome. I mean, someone like him, who's the big boss of the team, how often would you see a guy like that?
So, well, the cool thing is, with being reserve as well, because I'm there on every single weekend,
yep.
You know,
you're hanging there with him.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm hanging out with him, but yep. You know, I'm in the team with him and stuff like that, and I have access to go and see him and talk to him when I'd like, well, I guess when needed. So,
what's it take to be a boss like him of, you know, a team like Red Bull?
I couldn't imagine, honestly. It would be, yeah, with the amount of people involved, the amount of people to manage and things like that. And for Christian as well, I saw the stats the other day. I think 17 years now he's been sort of team principal of Red Bull Racing, which is by far the longest of any team principal in any Formula One team. So,
yep. He's got what he wanted now.
Yeah, whatever. So. Yeah, exactly.
What about Max Verstappen? I mean, did you have much of a relationship with a guy like him, who's, you know, top of the world?
Yeah,
at the moment?
He was very helpful to me actually before driving the car, and obviously I was driving his car, so. Yeah, but he was very helpful, and he's always been...
Just advice.
Even before I drove the car, just being on the weekends as reserve, he's an extremely nice guy. Really approachable, really friendly guy to talk to. Obviously, in the car, and every driver, you know, outside of the car, it's crazy how different you are outside to inside the car.
Mm. It all changes when you're inside.
Yeah, just like a switch, it's crazy. So, you can be completely friends. It's hard to have friends in motorsport, because especially guys you're racing against, because... you can be mates with them, but the second that you get in the car and something happens with them, you have to be able to get over it quickly. I had quite close with Yuri Vips. We lived in the same building this year, and we had a crash.
Who's he racing with?
He raced with Hi-Tech this year. And we had planned a trip to LA earlier in the year, and it had been like a month leading up to it. And the very last weekend, 3 days before we flew, we crashed together in Monza. And he completely wiped me out. Like, it was every driver's going to think it's the other person's fault, but he completely wiped me out. And
it was
his fault. This one was, you know, in the end he came to me and he apologized. But we had a massive argument about it afterwards, and then 2 hours later you sort of mates again and you're okay. And in the end our holiday was okay. So.
Well, that is good. Yeah. What about it like it? You know, your childhood hero over there, Lewis Hamilton. I'm just trying to get a sense. Would you see someone, obviously different teams and massive rivalry between those teams, but I'm just trying to get a sense, you there in your position as reserve driver, do you get to know a guy like him at all?
Lewis is, you don't see much of Lewis around the sort
pretty
of paddock.
Controlled.
Yeah, but the crazy thing is now, because of, especially like in the States and places, the thing with Drive to Survive, Formula One is... Exploded. Yeah,
totally.
The last couple of years. So even for us in Formula 2, I've it's crazy. I've never
well,
had...
Well, you got a cameo on Drive to Survive.
I know, with Yuki. And yeah. I think I'll be in the next series as well with some of the F1 stuff I did, which is quite cool. But it is crazy. I couldn't even imagine what it's like for some of those guys. In F1, especially guys like Lewis, you know, he's one of the biggest faces in Formula 1. So the second you leave... anywhere that's exposed to fans and stuff like that, you just get completely surrounded. So it's why you don't see sort of so much of those guys.
That Drive to Survive has been a remarkable phenomenon, right? I mean, my little boys, they can't get enough of it. I don't know when the next season's out, but we're waiting. We'll be straight onto it.
What team are they supporting?
With you sitting here, it has to be sort of Red Bull.
Is that true?
Alpha,
or
Atari. I mean, they like Daniel Ricciardo.
It was
a bit of fun. Yeah. And I'm just trying to think back what they... But I think it was Red Bull. And I think,
Ricardo's back with Red Bull now.
Because my sense would be, you know, but you're not saying this. I'm not putting words into your mouth, so don't worry. But, you know, my sense with Mercedes and Lewis, a little bit aloof. Actually, as the seasons have gone on, they've realised, I think, they need to spend a bit more focus on Drive to Survive because it is so big. But, you know, you don't see so much of them.
Yeah.
So... what'll be interesting, of course, is we haven't seen the season where Max Verstappen wins, and that'll wins decisively, I should say.
Yeah.
And so that'll be interesting to see how Red Bull goes as the not the underdog, but the top dog, if you like. Is it as glamorous as, in a sense, that makes it look? Is it, wine, money, or Red Bull in your case, and vodkas, parties, and celebrities, and beautiful people? And
you can. So, a lot of guys, a lot of drivers, I won't name anybody, but a lot of drivers, do, you can take advantage of it quite easy, the lifestyle, and go out a lot and stuff like that. It's just something I've never really done. So, but it's, I don't know what it's like to be a Formula One driver. I've only done that for a day. So, it's difficult for me to say, but
I've got it. You've done it three times.
Technically, three
you've
days.
You've gone
yes.
the you've got yourself twice into. Do you? I've shown my. Is it called a cockpit? What do you get into when you get into a?
We call it the office.
The office,
it's,
right?
It's a cockpit. Yeah, technically, it's a cockpit. Yeah.
Right. And F1 free practice session.
Yep.
Run me through how that sort of works and how it was you that gets to do that.
So
got to do that.
Yeah, Formula One a couple of years ago made sort of a rule that you had to put a, I don't know technically if it's a junior driver or somebody who hasn't done two official races or something like that in Formula One. And it's basically to, because it's Formula One so hard to get into. It's not like other sports, I'd say, where you get young guys consistently coming in. Formula One teams, because of how much money's involved, and even as simple as being able to say the right thing in the press and things like that, being the right face for the team, are more likely, it seems, to take an experienced driver over a young driver quite often.
Right.
So you have to be fully proven to get that opportunity, which is why it's so hard. So they've made it more accessible for juniors to have these opportunities. So two free practice sessions each team a year has to allocate to a driver who hasn't done, I think it's two official races. So that's how I was put in that position this year, and fortunate enough to do it with both AlphaTauri and Red Bull.
You're in 2023, in addition to being a reserve driver for Red Bull, which means I presume that you have to rock around wherever they go. Is that sort of how it works? If they're in Monaco, you're in Monaco.
Yep.
If they're in Abu Dhabi, you go to Abu Dhabi. And is it like being a reserve in the All Blacks or something? You're sitting there waiting?
Yeah, you are. You are. It's obviously very unlikely that you get that opportunity, but you are there just in case it does happen. So, and I think a couple of guys this year had that. Obviously, Nick de Vries, who in the end it completely sort of has launched him into Formula One because of it. He got that one opportunity and made the most of it. So, you have to be there for that opportunity if it does come.
So you're doing that, and then you're also in the 2023 Super Formula Championship in Japan.
Yep.
I mean, brief, what's that one all about? That is a clear, I mean, it was for Pierre Gasly, it's a stepping stone to F1.
Yeah, it's hard because a lot of people don't know about Super Formula because it's basically, in Japan, it's like Formula One. It's a really big series, a very, very high level as well. And most guys who go there for the first time do sort of struggle. So because it's very, very different. You're racing guys who race at these tracks, five tracks, and they race at them every single year for 7-8 years now. So it's a tough championship to go into. The cars are also really, really quick, and it's different. I'm driven on Pirelli tires now for 4 years. I'm going to drive on a completely different tire next year. So yeah, it's a lot to adjust to.
Yeah, I bet. You've said being an F1 is definitely where I want to be. But a lot still needs to happen. As close as we are, it's still a few steps away. What still needs to happen?
I just keep performing. Keep basically, as I said, I think there was potentially an opportunity this year with the seat in AlphaTauri opening up. But I just the Formula 2 season wasn't going as it needed to go. So,
because am I right? You came third
in the end. Yeah, I finished strongly. I came into the last week in like seventh, and we somehow came out third.
And I've got this right as well, the Dutch driver you mentioned, Nick de Vries, he came first?
Yeah, he did.
And so
A few years back.
Oh, is that right?
This is like, yeah, no, this
but,
is
But I mean,
is
it fair to say on performance, that's why he got an F1 slot and you did it? I'm spinning hard here. You back if I'm wrong.
He also did a couple more years in Formula 2.
Right.
And he's also, he's 27 years old now.
So what you're suggesting, some of it's a bit intangible, right? Is they make a judgment he got the call.
I'm always going to think that, you know, I deserve the seat more, but I'm not going to be biased and say that they should have put me in the car this year, because at the time Formula 2 was at, you know, I was running 7th or 8th in the championship. It wasn't going as it needed to have gone. It did finish strongly, but it finished, and I had great F1 sessions, but after those decisions had been made, sort of things. So
how well do you need to do in the Super Formula to kind of secure that slot in F1?
Best case, you need to be winning it. So and that sort of is going to be the best, gives me the best opportunity possible. But at the same time, it's when I get these F1 opportunities as well to perform in those sessions, because it's Formula 1 is so different, especially to Formula 2, that you get these hour-long slots when you do these free practice sessions. It's the only time you get to show the team what you're like in a Formula 1 car. So it's really, really, really important.
Is not getting to Formula 1 an option for you?
It's not an option. No, it's, yeah, I don't really know. Like, I've never considered anything else, even in motorsports. Like, initially when I was younger, it was, what's your backup plan in terms of career-wise, other than racing, what are you going to do? Because I left school, I was 15, so I don't have NCAA level one even. So it was always, what's your backup plan? You know, you're risking everything. But if you're thinking about anything else, if you're not 100% on, then you're never gonna go as far. So,
no. What's the typical age to enter F1 as a newbie? You have probably a sense of that? If you
22, I would say 22, 23 years old, 20, 21, 22, 23, something like that.
So you're in the zone.
Yeah, luckily, and that's why I said before about New Zealand, I'm 20, but I'm really experienced for a 20-year-old in terms of car driving. I've done a season of, in terms of just cars, not excluding karts, I've done Formula First, Formula Fords, Formula 4 twice. Then I've done Formula 3. I did 2 seasons of Formula 3 in 1 season. Then I did another season of Formula 3. Then I did Formula 2 with DTM. And then I did another season of Formula 2. And now I'm going to do Super Formula. So I've done like 10 or 11, maybe 12 seasons by the end of this year, or next year, of car racing, where a lot of guys go into Formula 4 at 16, for example, 17 years old. And they've only done maybe 5 seasons of car racing at that point.
Gotcha. I mean, your answer around Nick De Vries sort of told me something though, right? There are fine margins in who gets the call up, right? If there's 2-5 guys who are performing at an incredibly high level and they have to make a judgment call, they're making them on sometimes, non-performance related things, right? I suppose what I'm interested in is, you're a Kiwi from the bottom of the world. I hear what you say about our motorsport pedigree, right? You're absolutely right. We could run through the names, but you know, it's a long way. You haven't got $150 million behind you.
Yep.
There's politics at a level that comes into these things. Does that worry you?
It doesn't worry me. It's something that I just have to sort of, and I have just had to accept sort of for quite a few years now. It's just the way when the sport has this much money involved, there is politics in motorsport, and especially in Formula One. So it is what it is. It's another thing, I guess, that sort of for a few years now, it's not worth just thinking about or worrying about, because there's literally nothing I can do about it. So to answer your question, you know, about Nick, he had an opportunity this year in Monza to drive for Williams when Alex had to go and have surgery. So he drove the Williams car for the weekend, and mm-hmm. It was his first weekend in Formula One. And he absolutely nailed it. And I think, I guess that, you know, he had the opportunity, he took it and he nailed it. And that's what's put him in F1. So it's when you get this opportunity, making sure that you absolutely smash it.
You bet. And I wish you all the best. I want to ask you just a handful of quick fire questions. Your favourite Kiwi racetrack and why?
Favourite Kiwi racetrack is actually my favourite circuit in the entire world.
Right. Well, you've answered my next question as well then.
It's Highlands in the South, right. Islands.
Yep. Yeah, fantastic.
I absolutely love that track. So
I've been around it in someone else driving, and I think in the electric Porsche, I forget what it is.
Electric Porsche? Yeah. Was this recently?
Yeah, what is it?
Was it Taken?
Yeah, Taken, yeah.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, very good. Very, you know, they push the button and whoop.
It's,
well, it doesn't go whoom because it doesn't make any sound, right? But
makes it's electric car sound. No, it is extremely quick. So, but do you like the circuit?
Yeah, you bet. And yeah. You'll know him well. Quinn,
Tony
Quinn. I mean, sort of an Aussie, is he? Aussie Kiwi. He's done an amazing sort of thing for
incredible
Kiwi
yeah.
motorsport.
Motorsport, but for me, he's been a massive part of, especially this year, making this year happen for me. So. without him, it wouldn't have been possible. But yeah, like you say, for what he's doing for New Zealand
motorsport. And an amazing car collection he's got there, actually. Recommendation the to go to Highlands. Well, that is interesting. So you like it because the track is just...
New Zealand tracks in general are very exciting to drive. They are a lot like a lot of American tracks that IndyCar race on, you know, sort of if you make a mistake and you go wide, you don't just take a 5-second time penalty for track limits. You know, you're off in the grass, you're in the gravel, you're in the wall. It gives a certain level of excitement to drive. So I like that. And Highlands is one of the most exciting. You know, you have a big straight into a really high speed chicane, which is followed by a massive, it's more than 180 degrees, a loop with just a concrete wall right around the edge of it. So if you make a mistake, you're just in a concrete wall. And then it has a tunnel sort of underneath the top of the circuit with big cambered corners. It has a bridge where you literally take air, you know, the car goes four wheels off the ground. I took the Roden FZ car, so Roden's been a massive part of also my career in the last couple of years. And I took the Formula One car, the FZ Formula One car around Highlands, and that was one of the scariest but also one of the most exciting things I've ever done in a race car around that circuit. So, and the facilities as well, like you said, the museum, just the place. You've seen the toilets that Tony's put
fantastic.
In now?
Yeah, fantastic. A lot of fun.
Yeah. It's a really cool place, yeah.
Highlight of your career so far?
The free practice session with Red Bull in Abu Dhabi.
Low light. Has there been one, actually?
Like lowest, you mean like lowest? Yeah, for sure. There's, I think about the lowest point. I would say DTM. Yeah, DTM finale we had. Fighting for the championship last year, all the way through the year, and we led into the last weekends. I got basically completely smashed out. In a really ridiculous way, basically in the last race, we put the car on pole. We literally did everything right, and I built an amazing relationship with Ferrari and with Red Bull in this weird Ferrari Red Bull put together season where we all worked together, and then got completely shattered in the last race. So that was a
sorry very tough one. Sorry to hear that.
That's right.
What qualities make the best racing car driver?
Balance between bravery and precision. I don't know, something like that. It's hard to say. You can be brave, but it's also can be stupid. So
it's getting that right,
the balance,
and either side slightly, and you've got it wrong. Have you got those qualities?
I'd like to think so. It's hard for me to say personally, but yeah.
The best racing car driver in the world today?
The problem with that question is to be at Formula One level, every driver believes they're the best. So, and you can't be at this level if you don't believe you're the best. So I'm not going to out there and say it, but personally, everybody believes they're the best.
I love it. What about best ever then?
Best ever.
You know, you follow this and you're young. What did you sort of say? You said that person is the one I look to and say, man, they were in their day and at their time the best.
If I go, exclude the last 5 years, let's say, before I was a racing, you know, before this sort of time, from what I've seen, Senna was pretty incredible. It's in Senna, yeah. So I've watched his movie so many times.
That movie's amazing.
Yeah, I would say that I would have loved to have seen that in person, that sort of era that he was in. I think that he's probably him alongside Schumacher, Michael.
Yeah, amazing. How much is, and this justifies a long answer, but we've got time. How much is the team in the car versus the driver? Because I suppose what watching Drive to Survive suggests to me is, you know what, it's the team and the car. And you can be the best driver, but you're sitting there in Haas. You've got no show. It's a bit harsh on poor old Haas. And what is it, Gunter or whatever his name is?
Finally, good to say,
he seems like a good bastard. But anyway, what's your...
Yeah, it's not like, you know, even other motorsports, let's say, like sports like... there's always an element of how good the equipment you're on is, obviously. So, you know, you look at motocross or MotoGP or other series like that where... It's say more down to the athlete or the rider or the driver or something like that. But in Formula One and Formula Two and all these categories, it's it's very much down to the team as well, and how well you work with your team. Obviously, it's really important. The relationship you have with your race engineer, the guy that you talk to at basically during the session, when you're in the car, when you're out of the car, it's really important. And the relationship you guys have, if it's not completely strong or it's not really connected, it can make a massive, massive difference. So yeah, it's I would say as much down to the team, the equipment, stuff like that, as the driver.
Do you drive much on normal roads these days, and is it a struggle to treat them or not treat them like a racing track?
No, it's not a struggle. It's funny because most people would get in the car with me and they're always like, don't forget, Liam, it's not a racetrack, and stuff like that. And it's really frustrating because it's a
obviously patronizing of them.
I know. It's like it feels unfair, but I get it. But like my dad, for example, I went around with him. Literally, it's just funny. I went around with him yesterday and it was wet. And I was I have quite a cool car I'm driving around at the moment. It's a Golf R, which is one of my favorite cars. And I was showing him around.
Beat up Golf R.
Yeah, exactly. The Mark 8 one, the new one. And it was wet, and we're driving around sort of the back streets of Pukekohe, and I wasn't going, you know, I wasn't driving it like a racetrack, but he's freaking out in the passenger seat, and he's like, you know, oh, Liam, the slick patchy, you know, you can't hit that, you know, watch for that, and this is the part. And I said to him, what do you think I do when you're not here? Do you think that I'm just in trouble at, you know, 100% of the time? So yeah, and for my dad not to trust me kind of sucks, but I think it's quite funny, but it's not hard not to. It's not like everything I see is a racetrack.
No.
It's a completely different thing.
You're not that mono-dimensional. No, I'm sure that's true. I wish you all the best. I'd love nothing more as a patriotic Kiwi as see you not only in F1 but at podiums. So, you know, we'll be watching with real interest.
Thank
you. It's time to wrap up with the questions I ask everyone. We call it general knowledge. And I know you've been stressing out about these because we gave you about 2 minutes preparation.
Well, you did. You can be honest. You gave them to me yesterday and I read them, but I completely forgot to actually think about them. So this is on me. Yeah.
What's the best night out you've ever had?
I raced in Macau a couple of years ago. Basically, I was, I can't remember how old I was, 17 or 18 years old. And there's like this basic club, this place that everybody, it's huge and everybody goes to it, all the drivers, all the teams, stuff like that. And it was one of the first times I'd really gone out. It's still really one of the only times I've ever gone out. And yeah, it was a pretty cool place. So it was just a place in Macau was probably the best one.
If you could be any animal, what would it be and why?
I have absolutely no idea.
Well, it's not going to be like it. You're not going to be a meerkat or something.
No, it's going to be.
Meerkats don't win Formula 1.
I was trying to think what's a fast animal, like a, I don't know, like a cheetah or something like that. But I don't know. I think it'd be pretty cool to be something in the ocean, like to swim around like they do. And it sounds pretty stupid, but I don't know. Like what animal is in the ocean that live really, like a shark or something like
We're
that?
We're going shark.
I reckon I'd go shark. Not
fast,
a great white shark.
Sleek shark.
Yeah, like a...
that's good at turning.
Mako shark, right? They're pretty fast.
And if you're not lucky, it'll turn up in batter at a fish
true.
And chip shop when they tell you
I don't
want to
be a stupid shark then that you know, takes that bites lures and stuff like that. Hey, let's be a smart one, yeah.
Excellent. Who would you most like to be trapped in a lift with?
It's a really tricky question.
You really didn't give this any thought beforehand, did you?
No, I didn't. Let's just because my girlfriend's sitting here, let's say my girlfriend I'd most likely want to be stuck in a lift with.
That's very romantic. And I hope it gets you brownie points that last you for a very long...
I hope so too.
..a very long time. Liam Lawson, soon to be Formula One driver, we hope and believe. Thanks so much. You've been listening to Generally Famous. There's a new episode every Wednesday. You can listen to them all at stuff.co.nz/generallyfamous or wherever you get your podcasts. If you follow us on Apple or Spotify, any of the podcast apps, in fact, you'll get the latest episode automatically. I'd love to hear from you. Send your feedback to generallyfamous@stuff.co.nz. Thanks to my producers, Chris Reed and Jen Black. I'm Simon Bridges. I really appreciate you listening.
If you liked listening to this pod, Help us make more like this. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.
Hey, Chris.
Yes.
Do you want another very broad question? I've got a very broad question today.
Go on then.
What do you know about sports?
Up the Wazz! Go the Black Caps. And don't forget Premier League football.
Oh, you do love a bit of Premier League footage, don't you? What team is it that you support again?
Oh, the current champions, Manchester City.
I think they're pronounced Arsenal. It's pronounced Arsenal.
But you know what's good about football?
Yeah, what?
They don't regulate soccer height.
I'm sorry? There's a sport that regulates sock height?
Indeed there is, and it's cycling.
That's very strange. Why on earth do they regulate it?
Well, I know, but if you want to find out, you'll have to listen to the Big Stuff Quiz, wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, that's a cliffhanger indeed. The Big Stuff Quiz is brought to you by Melbourne Every Bit Different.